Friends and comrades, we keep updating this episode with new numbers, but we cannot keep up with the death toll in Gaza. We know that by the time we publish this, our numbers will already be out of date. So far today, October 31st, the number of Palestinian children killed, just the children, is more than 3,500. But there are more than 2,000 Palestinian children missing in Gaza, so that's at least 5,500 Palestinian children who are likely dead in just 3 weeks. 5,500 children. The official death toll is now more than 8,500, mostly women and children. But there are many, many more missing. This is the most horrific, gruesome mass slaughter of civilians that I have ever seen in my lifetime.
Massive demonstrations calling for a ceasefire in Gaza continued this weekend, including here in New York City. On Friday night, thousands of members of Jewish Voice for Peace New York City and their allies shut down the main terminal of Grand Central Station during rush hour. It's the largest sit-in protest the city has seen in over two decades. Many wore shirts that said, "Not in our name." Banners were unfurled reading, "Palestinians should be free," and "Israelis demand ceasefire now." One sign read, "Never again for anyone."
My name is Rosalind Pacheski. I'm here with maybe 1,000 others, a lot of us Jews, but we are here to protest the genocide that is happening in our name. It has to stop. We believe in justice and the right to live for everyone. But Palestinians have been the victims of oppression for 75 years, and it has to stop. That's why we're here, to say not in our name. I am older than the state of Israel.
For the genocide of Palestinians. In over 2.5 weeks, we've already seen more than 7,000 Palestinians be killed, close to 3,000 Palestinian children, one Palestinian child killed every 15 minutes. These New Yorkers and so many across the state are saying the time is now for a ceasefire, and if you're not calling for it, you're supporting a genocide.
And what's your name?
I'm Fee.
And why are you getting arrested?
I was born in a refugee camp in the Philippines. I'm Vietnamese. I am a child of imperialism, so I can't see it go on. I can't see it continue.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Never again for anyone!
Never again for anyone!
Never again is now!
Never again is now!
That audio was courtesy of Democracy Now! These are just a few of the voices from Jewish Voice for Peace and their allies who shut down the main terminal of Grand Central Station during rush hour on Friday, October 27th, in one of New York's largest acts of civil disobedience in two decades. About 400 people were arrested, including famous actors, rabbis, and elected officials.
Today, we continue our emergency coverage of Palestine as the death toll soars in the dark. Gaza is without electricity, largely without internet, and the complete carpet bombing continues as Israel and the United States prepare for a ground invasion. Please consider making an urgently needed donation to Crawdads and Taters as we are ramping up coverage during this genocide. As we find ourselves in the midst of an information war where critical voices are being censored, banned, and even bombed, we need your support now more than ever. Please become a subscriber for as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/crawdadsandtaters. So Israel continues to carpet bomb the whole of the Gaza Strip for a 24th consecutive day. These numbers, 8,500 dead and 1.4 million people displaced, do not include several thousand missing Palestinians who are presumed to be dead and or trapped under the rubble.
As of Friday, the 27th of October, all internet and electricity were cut to Gaza, in addition to water, food, medicines, and fuel. So media outlets will not be able to receive communications from the Gaza Health Ministry, nor will anyone be able to receive any communication from Gaza. This is a total blackout. And Israeli tanks have now invaded the northern Gaza Strip overnight in what military leaders are calling a targeted ground raid ahead of a much larger ground invasion.
We know that Al Jazeera has been the only major media outlet on the ground in Gaza for the last few weeks. Al Jazeera is funded in large part by Qatar. We also know that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told Qatar to tone down its media coverage of the war on Gaza. And then just 2 weeks later, this last week, Al Jazeera's bureau chief, Wael Daoudou, his entire family was bombed in a targeted airstrike. His family was staying in a refugee camp in a presumably safer part of southern Gaza. The airstrike killed his wife, his two children, and his grandchild. This hardly seems like a coincidence.
Meanwhile, hospitals and UN refugee centers are running out of food, water, and fuel. Fuel is super crucial because it runs generators, it provides electricity, it keeps incubators running in infant care units, it provides fuel to bakeries to make bread, one of the few foods left in Gaza. As of Thursday, 120 newborns in incubators, including premature babies, were at risk of dying within minutes should oxygen be shut off. We still don't know what has happened with that situation.
UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, says it is close to running out of supplies in Gaza, where it is sheltering over 650,000 displaced Palestinians. Israel has claimed that they cannot allow fuel to enter the besieged territory because of the supposed risk of it being appropriated by Hamas.
UNRWA, as a UN agency, provides very rigorous accounting for all the supplies it receives, checking all UNRWA staff members and recipients of aid against a UN Security Council sanctions list. But Israel prefers collective punishment and killing babies. I mean, why would we believe anything else? That's all they've been doing for 21 days, disobeying all the rules of war, all international law, carpet bombing Gaza, targeting refugee centers, hospitals, churches, mosques. Why would we believe they would care about babies in incubators? They don't.
That's right. They don't. And their genocidal rhetoric matches their actions. Since October 7th, Netanyahu and his newly formed war cabinet have been vowing to wipe Hamas, Lebanon, and Iran off the face of the earth. He also routinely refers to the people of Gaza as the people of darkness, while he refers to the Israelis as the people of light.
He also often references Amalek. This is a specific Bible verse from 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 3. It reads, quote, "Now go, attack the Amalekites, and totally destroy all that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys," end quote. This is genocidal. He's telling his soldiers to kill everyone. You know, this is very clear when he makes this reference to Amalek.
Yeah,
And this whole people of darkness, people of light bullshit, I mean, how racist is that? Gaza is populated mainly by Arabs, and Israel is largely European. It's straight up white supremacist.
Yeah, this, I don't know, it might sound better in the original German, I don't know.
German? What are you talking about?
It's coming straight from Nazi rhetoric.
Oh. Did Hitler call people the people of darkness and light?
I don't know if he specifically said that. It sounds very similar to the chosen race, you know, the Aryan race, the master race.
Yeah, it's very similar. People of darkness, people of light, the master race. I mean, it sounds like it comes straight out of the Aryan Nation handbook. It's fully white supremacist.
Yep.
Netanyahu also frequently references 1948, the year of the Nakba, in his speeches, and he always calls it a, quote, great victory. This was the catastrophe that we talked about in our last episode after Israeli statehood, where 750,000 Palestinians were displaced and there were over 50 massacres carried out by Israeli troops.
Right. And so at the same time that Netanyahu is giving all these speeches with all this racist rhetoric, Biden is doing his part back here in the United States to make sure that Palestinian deaths don't count. Here is a clip of him from last week.
I'm sure innocents have been killed, and it's the price of waging a war, but I have no confidence in the number that the Palestinians are using.
Okay, so Biden's claiming the Palestinian numbers aren't reliable. All of a sudden, he's doubting the accuracy of their numbers. This is a form of strategic ambiguity and political cover for war crimes, so that Israel can just keep doing what it's doing without any consequence. As long as Biden disregards the numbers, then there can't be any consequence of those numbers.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous that he doesn't accept, you know, the same numbers that the UN and the entire world accepts to be completely accurate.
Mm-hmm. And we know that the U.S. State Department has routinely relied on numbers from Gaza's health ministry in the past. But suddenly it decides that the Gaza Health Ministry can no longer count its own dead. So as a response to Biden, the Gaza Health Ministry published the names of more than 6,700 Palestinians killed since Israel launched its assault on Gaza 3 weeks ago. The 200-plus page report lists the names, age, gender, and ID number of each of Israel's victims of this aerial bombardment. The toll does not include the names of at least 281 people whose bodies were so disfigured that they couldn't be identified, nor does it include a few thousand Palestinians missing and believed to be trapped under the rubble.
Right. Yeah, these numbers, we can definitely rely on the numbers. We cannot rely on old Genocide Joe to ever tell the truth.
Nope.
Meanwhile, a majority of nations in the UN are pushing for an immediate ceasefire, and mass protests are being held in major capital cities and other cities all over the world. I think there was 100,000 people in London.
Yeah, I saw some photos. The protests were enormous. And here in the United States, Jewish Voice for Peace and its allies continued their protests. More than 400 were arrested for shutting down a major terminal in Grand Central Station in New York for demanding a ceasefire. This is on top of the more than 500 protesters who were arrested last week.
So once again, we see the Jewish community helping to lead the resistance in the United States to this ongoing genocide, this Zionist genocide of the Palestinian people.
And as we talked about in our last episode, it's such an encouraging development to see this mass Jewish solidarity with Palestinians. They're taking a huge stand and saying, never again, not in my name.
In spite of this amount of resistance and popular support for the Palestinian people for a ceasefire, only 19 U.S. Congress people have signed a resolution for a ceasefire. And at the same time, the Biden regime, as well as the Senate, have shown an unprecedented level of U.S. support, including political support, such as condemning protesters, in addition to requesting an additional $14 billion in aid for Israel, which would be on top of the almost $4 billion that Israel receives each year already. And this is primarily military aid.
Wow. So as Congress is repressing protest and censoring free speech, We have an unprecedented amount of military aid going to Israel this year, $18 billion. And just for some perspective, this past year, the United States gave $3 billion in total foreign aid to all of Latin America and the Caribbean. $3 billion. Compare that to more than $120 billion that has gone to Ukraine, or the $18 billion that Israel will now receive this year. Israel has a population of 9.4 million. Latin America has a population of more than 650 million people, and it received $3 billion in total aid last year.
And Biden wants to spend at least that much on increased border security as well, when, you know, maybe helping out the populations of these countries in Latin America that the United States has sanctioned and installed right-wing dictators in would do something about the amount of refugees coming from those countries who are seeking shelter in the United States. But instead, he wants to militarize the border.
Right, because the Biden regime doesn't give a shit what actually causes people to become refugees, because it's just much more profitable to funnel all this money into the military-industrial complex and the police state.
Yeah, and all that money in Israel is going to go directly to turning, you know, everyone in Gaza into a refugee. The 2.3 million people who live in Gaza, we already have over a million of them are displaced.
Yeah, all over the Arab world. Palestinians have been living in all the surrounding countries around Palestine for decades. Many of them were pushed out in 1948. And continued to be pushed out in the decades since then. But what's happening now, this unprecedented mass slaughter, it is another huge displacement and at the level of genocide. Palestinians are calling this another Nakba, and Israel's Zionist leadership is celebrating that.
Israel has U.S. financial and political backing. We see more support from Israel from Biden than any recent president. In fact, here is Biden in 2016 repeating something he has said many times.
Were I a Jew, I would be a Zionist. And my father pointed out to me, I did not need to be a Jew to be a Zionist. For I am. Israel is essential the security of Jews worldwide.
So that clip is from 2016, and we know that Biden has said he's a Zionist many times throughout his very long political career.
Yeah, along with saying that, you know, if Israel didn't exist, we'd have to create it.
Wow. Yeah.
And I know he's taken, you know, more money from Israel lobbyists than I think any other politician over his career.
Yeah. In fact, I just saw a stat on that the other day. Biden has received more than $4.2 million from Israeli lobbyists, according to Open Secrets. And here he is saying, you don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist.
Yeah. He just takes money hand over fist from Zionists and suddenly he's a Zionist.
In our last episode, we looked at some of the history of this region, and we talked about the definition of genocide and apartheid. And we talked about religious justifications for genocide, but we stopped short of actually defining Zionism. So for people who may not be familiar with Zionism, we think it's really important that we define it, because to be Jewish is not to be a Zionist. In fact, to assume that to be Jewish is to be Zionist is something that I believe is actually anti-Semitic. There are many Jewish people who are not Zionists all over the world, and there are many who are. And there are also a lot of non-Jews who are Zionists who are profiting off of Israelis' expansion and occupation of Palestine, like President Biden.
Define it. According to Al Jazeera, Zionism is a colonial movement supporting the establishment by any means necessary of a national state for Jews in historic Palestine. Zionism is a nationalist political ideology that called for the creation of a Jewish state, a land for a people without a land, and now supports the continued existence of Israel as such a state. Theodor Herzl, an Austrian Jew, is considered the father of political Zionism. The Zionist movement started in the late 19th century amidst growing European anti-Semitism. The movement secured support among Western European governments, particularly after Zionists agreed to create their Jewish state in historic Palestine. The Zionists' early objective was to claim as much of historic Palestine as possible by driving out the Palestinian population. This was the first Nakba, or catastrophe, as Palestinians call it, an ethnic cleansing in 1948 upon the creation of the State of Israel. We talked about this in the last episode.
Zionists actively encouraged the mass migration of European Jews to Palestine during the first half of the 20th century. Despite their efforts and the sharp rise in anti-Semitism in Europe culminating in the Nazi persecution, Arabs still outnumbered Jews in Palestine. So, as the likes of Israeli historian Ilan Pape have argued, Zionist leaders were well aware that implementing their project would necessitate the ethnic cleansing of the indigenous Palestinian population. Palestinians were displaced from parts of 520 communities that Israeli troops erased back to the earth in 1948, committing 50 massacres and pushing some 750,000 Palestinians out of Palestine. And now, with already more than 1.4 million Gazans displaced, Israel is celebrating, openly stating that it wants to wipe Palestine and Gaza off the map. So Zionism already contains within it a willingness to commit genocide. That national state for Jews comes, quote, by any means necessary.
Right. I also want to quote here from an article called Zionist Settler Colonialism by Sumaya Awad and Annie Levin. They say, quote, Zionist settler colonialism did not come to exploit the Arabs, but instead sought to completely replace them. The goal was to create an exclusively Jewish state with a Jewish majority. In order to achieve this, Zionists had to destroy the Palestinian economy, steal the land, drive the Arabs out of the labor market, and erase the very memory they'd ever been there. This meant carrying out a war on a number of fronts reflected in the three slogans of the pioneer Zionists: conquest of land, conquest of labor, and produce of the land, end quote.
So I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about settler colonialism as a main lens for how we look at this situation, especially coming from United States history. We are experts in settler colonialism in this country. It's really helpful, at least for me, to understand what's happened to Palestine and Palestinians as the indigenous people of those lands, as to what happened here in the Americas to the indigenous people of our lands. And we can compare the occupation of both of these lands and the history of occupation in such a way that really illuminates what settler colonialism is and how it works. So I just wanted to mention that in both cases, there's a religious justification. In the Americas, you know, it went all the way back to the papal bulls of England from the 15th century, which actually gave the right to the English to occupy and colonize all non-Christian lands around the world. It said that Christians had the right to claim the land of all non-Christian savages. And these papal bulls were brought to the United States when it was first founded as a colony. And they are, by the way, still among the founding documents of the United States and used as legal precedents in our court system still to this day. They give the colonizers rights to be here and to occupy indigenous lands based on 15th century law from England that non-Christians are savages and don't have rights to these lands. So that's a really good example of settler colonialism and the laws and the religion that govern it. And we can understand the Jewish claim to Palestine in a similar way. And that's why we're using this lens of settler colonialism to understand the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has long been recognized as illegal under international law.
Right. The rules-based international order of the United States has completely ignored those declarations that, you know, show that Israel is, in fact, violating international law. But, you know, to go back to colonialism, I'm going to quote here from Ilan Pape, a Jewish historian who has written numerous books about the history of Israel and the history of Palestine. This is coming from his book, 10 Myths About Israel. Quote, colonialism can be described as the movement of Europeans to different parts of the world, creating new white nations where indigenous people had once had their own kingdoms. These nations could only be created if the settlers employed two logics. The logic of elimination, getting rid by all means possible of the indigenous people, including by genocide, and the logic of dehumanization, regarding the non-Europeans as inferior and thus as not deserving the same rights as the settlers. In South Africa, these twin logics led to the creation of the apartheid system, founded officially in 1948. The same year that the Zionist movement translated the same logics into an ethnic cleansing operation in Palestine, end quote. So we can kind of look at South Africa and Israel as, you know, two examples of modern day apartheid states that are based on settler colonialism. And I think it's important to note that up until 2007, the United States still considered Nelson Mandela to be a terrorist. He was the great, you know, leader who fought for, you know, the end of the apartheid state in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I think a big lesson we can learn from this is that, you know, the United States obviously backs apartheid states. And we've learned from the recent U.S.-backed proxy wars in Ukraine and now this ongoing war in the Israel-Palestinian conflict, which has been ongoing for 75 years and has been backed by the United States the entire time.
The entire time, right? Since 1948.
Yeah, since 1948, the United States was the first country to recognize Israel as a state.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the United States is funding the Israeli war machine with almost $4 billion per year, which it has been doing as long as I can remember. Since 1948, when Israel became a state, the United States has provided Israel with $130 billion in assistance, not adjusted for inflation. And this has primarily been military assistance, including white phosphorus artillery shells, which are banned for use in urban areas by international law. And Israel has been using white phosphorus in the current conflict as well as in previous conflicts against Gaza and in Lebanon. And as we've been saying, the main enemy is at home. U.S. imperialism is a root cause of this issue. The United States was the first country to recognize Israel and is now its greatest ally. And if it weren't for U.S. support, it is unlikely that Israel would even exist today in the way that it does now. The war crimes of Israel are as much the responsibility of the United States as they are of Israel. Israel is our proxy state, our puppet state that has helped us wage most of our wars in the Middle East. It has been our military outpost for all of its existence, even as Israel and the United States are moving closer and closer to fascism.
And they have been continuously supplying Israel, backing them in everything. And so this is, you know, something we've touched on before is the fact that the main enemy is at home. And, you know, we're here in the United States, so we need to focus on U.S. imperialism. As Carl Liebknecht said, the main enemy is at home, the famous German Marxist. So I want to play this clip here from the United States Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre and show just how terrible this enemy is. You know, we already listened to Biden some, so here's another spokesperson for U.S. Empire.
What is the president's message to members of Congress who seem to be equating the Hamas terror attack with actions that were previously taken by Israel?
Look, here's the thing, and which congressional members?
Well, there have been some members of Congress who have called for a ceasefire, and they have not gone as far as backing the administration's call for support for Israel.
So look, I've seen some of those statements this weekend, and we're going to continue to be very clear. We believe they're wrong. We believe they're repugnant, and we believe they're disgraceful. Our condemnation belongs squarely with terrorists who have brutally murdered, raped, kidnapped hundreds of Israelis. There can be no equivocation about that. There are not two sides here. President Biden has been clear on where he has stood. You heard from him directly today. You heard from him also on Saturday on this. There's been multiple statements from this president, and he's taking action to provide additional support to ensure that Israel has what they need to defend themselves.
So that was the press secretary of the United States
saying that calls for a ceasefire are repugnant.
Right, and that there are no two sides. That's completely disgusting, predictable, as the United States defends its proxy state. Of course, that's what they're going to say, but the idea that you can't even call for a ceasefire when there's an active genocide going on, and that a ceasefire is repugnant when there's an active genocide going on.
Yeah, she is equating the members of Congress, the very few, there may be maybe 20 at the most, who have called for a ceasefire to supporting terrorism.
Unbelievable. It takes a lot of moral gymnastics to be able to twist and distort what's going on into people who are terrorists who are calling for an end to violence.
That's only sane thing is to call for an end to the violence.
That's the only sane thing. I mean, the United Nations is calling for ceasefire. Everybody in the world except for the U.S. and its allies are calling for a ceasefire.
Yeah, so she is correct that there are no two sides here. We can't both sides this situation because one side is committing genocide and the other side is an oppressed population, the Palestinians, who are doing everything they can to try to survive genocide. But obviously the United States is coming down firmly on the side of Israel, who is committing this genocide. So I just kind of want to contrast that with another clip from Dr. Gaber Mate explaining how there are no two sides here. So here he is.
There are no two sides. I mean, it's always a complex question, but in terms of power and control, and it's pretty straightforward. There was a land with a people living there, and other people wanted it. They took it over, and they continue to take it over, and they continue to discriminate against, oppress, and dispossess that other people. That's what happened, and that's what's happening.
So there were two very different takes on the there's no two sides theory. But in the case of the United States propaganda coming from the White House, as we've said at the beginning of this section, it's clear that the main enemy is at home. So we want to take a look at another lens through which we can understand this whole conflict. And for those of you who've been following our work through our Ukraine series, you know that we talked a lot about how late stage capitalism is about military accumulation. In the face of a declining U.S. empire, the United States is relying more and more heavily on directing the lion's share of its finances towards war and maintaining its fragile empire. We've always been a war economy, but we are now a war economy more than ever.
Which means that the U.S. needs to maintain proxy states around the world to conduct its wars. Ukraine and Israel are the two most recent examples. Looking throughout history, we can see, you know, CIA interventions and U.S.-backed coups all over the world in the last 200 years for all kinds of reasons. These interventions from the overthrow of Allende in Chile, Arbenz in Guatemala, Gaddafi in Libya, Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. The U.S. has always used foreign governments as proxies to advance its own geopolitical interests and colonial expansions, as well as the interests of private capital.
And as we have quoted before, sociologist William I. Robinson has thoroughly documented the fact that global capitalism is becoming more and more dependent upon war making to sustain itself. So not just U.S. capitalism, but global capitalism is become more and more dependent on war making. He says in a recent article, quote, shares of military and security firms surged in the wake of the Russian invasion. Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics. Our wars today are all about increasing stocks for weapons manufacturers and soaring profits. And when the war started in Ukraine, as Robinson noted, the war industry, the military industrial complex, actually said, happy days are here again.
Yeah, and it's the same thing now with the increased bombing in Israel, the genocide ongoing.
Biden has just called for a $105 billion spending bill, which includes $60 billion for Ukraine and $14 billion for Israel. And it is estimated that around half of this would go directly to defense companies.
Wow.
And this is just disgusting, the fact that they're just sending money to the military-industrial complex with no regard for the casualties involved in these projects. War is a racket, as Major General Smedley Butler said back in the 1930s. It continues today. These are for-profit wars, and the U.S. does not care who dies in the process. And I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians are now dead because of this U.S. proxy war that they started in Ukraine. And we have over 4,000 Palestinians dead now. And the U.S. is vetoing ceasefires and calling calls for ceasefires repugnant. And the U.S. may back down from this empire building and genocide funding only when it thinks it's getting too much bad press and might start to lose public support. But even in that case, I don't know if they actually would. It requires a huge amount of lost public support, a huge amount of protests like we saw at the Vietnam War. And that took years and years for the U.S. to finally shut down their military operation in spite of having no public support left in the 70s.
Yeah. And I know there are a lot of liberals in the United States that like to think that the government still has our best interests in mind or somehow still cares about human rights and democracy around the world. We know that's complete bullshit at this point. Like, it's so far, those myths have been so blown out of the water, even in the last 5 or 6 years, not to mention the fact that if you do any kind of critical look at U.S. history, you can see that our funding of dictators, fascist dictators, authoritarian regimes, and using all of these governments as our proxy states around the world for the last couple of centuries really shows that our main interest is capitalist expansion, which gets into our next section about disaster capitalism. We talked a little bit earlier about disaster capitalism and the shock doctrine, but we just want to introduce it once more as a lens to really understand what's happening right now. At this moment, we're all just so shocked and dismayed and in disbelief, really, about the level of genocide and killing that's going on in Palestine. And it's so traumatizing to everybody who witnesses it, much less the people who are involved, that it's easy to get disoriented and forget that this violence is not for nothing, that there's probably actually a larger geopolitical and profit agenda attached to it. We talked earlier about 9/11 and the shock that happened after 9/11, and then how the hijackers of the planes that hit the Twin Towers were Saudi Arabian mainly, and then the U.S. decides to go to war with Iraq and Afghanistan for the next couple of decades and wages a geopolitical war over oil fields in those countries. Throughout U.S. empire's history, every time the U.S. invades or occupies or commits mass atrocities in another country, it's always tied to some kind of geopolitical resource or control over land. In all of our coups, all of our interventions, it's the same for Israel. So we just wanted to point out something that's not coincidental, because Biden's been talking about it and Netanyahu's been talking about it. For a few weeks now, Israel has been bragging about this new corridor that it wants to build that will expand Israel in several directions so that it goes from river to river on top of several different countries. And now you have the United States threatening Iran, and Israel is threatening Lebanon and provoking war all over the region, assuming, of course, that the United States and Western Europe will continue to have its back. And so we actually wanted to play a clip from Netanyahu where he talks about this new corridor and what he's hoping will happen for his country.
2 weeks ago, we saw another blessing already in sight. In the G20 conference, President Biden, Prime Minister Modi, and European and Arab leaders announced plans for a visionary corridor that will stretch across the Arabian Peninsula and Israel. It will connect India to Europe with maritime links, rail links, energy pipelines, fiber optic cables. This corridor will bypass maritime checkpoints, or choke points rather, and dramatically lower the cost of goods, communication, and energy for over 2 billion people. What a historic change for my country. Today, I bring this marker to show a great blessing, the blessing of a new Middle East between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and our other neighbors. We will not only bring down barriers between Israel and our neighbors, we'll build a new corridor of peace and prosperity that connects Asia through the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, to Europe. This is an extraordinary change, a monumental change, another pivot of history.
So that presentation made by Netanyahu was in September of 2023. He's standing before the United Nations and he's holding a map showing where this new corridor is going to be. He draws a big red line through several countries showing where this corridor, how it's going to unite all these Arab countries around Israel. And it's noteworthy to tell you that Palestine is not on that map at all. It's like it just doesn't even exist. So when we look at how Palestine and Gaza are being bombed to smithereens right now, you can understand how this is likely part of a very strategic geopolitical plan that is going to involve some sort of capitalist expansionist project that will enrich wealthy nations at the expense of poor nations and poor people and refugees and people who have been under genocide for decades. So this is why we must end capitalism at the end of the day. I mean, this is about capitalism. Capitalism is always an expansionist project. It always has to grow, and it always grows at the expense of the working class, the poor, and the most vulnerable. Nature. And there's always an imperialist dynamic, as Lenin noted in the highest stage of capitalism is imperialism, as he discussed that at length. There's always an imperialist dynamic where the richest nations are exploiting the poorest nations. And this is why capitalism is not a sustainable project, not for nature, not for humans, not for anybody. It leads to perpetual war. And so when capitalism has reached the level that it's at, we just see, again, the ruling class reaping all of the benefits while the poor, the working classes, the indigenous people of the world pay the price.
Religion is being used as a justification, you know, especially in this case with Zionism. But it's, yes, being weaponized for profit for capitalist expansion. Israel has weaponized the very legitimate pain and grief of the Jewish Holocaust survivors in order to manipulate them into genocidal projects of capitalist expansion. I don't think there's any other way to really say that.
Right. And as the Red Nation has said many times, in order for our relatives to live, capitalism and colonialism must die.
Yeah. So in conclusion, in Gaza, the entire population of refugees is paying for this expansionist project with their lives. Whatever it ends up being, a railroad, a canal, a corridor, pipelines, and Netanyahu mentioned all those things. And it's gotten no press and no analysis in the United States. We didn't even know about this here.
Yeah, it took one of my Palestinian friends to point this out to me, that this is the bigger plan that's going on behind the scenes. And so speaking about the fact that it's gotten no press, we often talk about how the United States is one of the most propagandized countries in the world. And our media, our corporate media, supports war-making and empire-building projects, and it always has. And it's so important to say, as we've said many times throughout the Ukraine war, that we are in the midst of an information war right now. And the U.S. has so much practice providing propaganda for Israel. It's been doing it for decades because it has been our proxy state in the Middle East for decades. And this has been very well documented. The propaganda has been very well documented. I mean, even back in the 90s, I saw this really amazing documentary, if you can find it, called Peace, Propaganda, and the Promised Land, about the way that the U.S. media only reports on Israeli victims, not Palestinian victims, the way it spins every story and humanizes Israeli victims of the conflict and dehumanizes Palestinian victims, and just on and on and on with the propaganda. It's been part of our system for decades.
the media has been completely captured. And we know this because according to a 2023 report by the Institute for Public Accuracy, BlackRock and Vanguard are the two largest shareholders in the six major media companies that control more than 90% of the U.S. media landscape. So, you know, to break that down, that means that 90% of the media in the United States is controlled by just six corporations: AT&T, CBS, Comcast, Disney, News Corp, and Viacom. And these six corporations, the largest stockholders, are BlackRock and Vanguard, the investment companies who have their fingers in pretty much everything.
Including the military-industrial complex.
Yes, they're heavily invested in weapons. And so it doesn't matter which news network you listen to, CNN, NBC, CBS, Fox News, MSNBC, they are all in bed with and funded by the same corporations that profit off of war. So, you know, the coverage that we're seeing of the conflict, of the genocide in Israel, it's disgusting on the mainstream media. And they're even more violent in their rhetoric than the government that's waging these wars. We saw the same thing with Ukraine. I just want to play this example clip from CNN of Betzalel Toljaj, an Israeli defense force, or really Israeli offensive force soldier, whose mother was killed during the Hamas resistance. And this clip, yeah, well, just listen to it yourself here.
My understanding is that you are actively leading a number of soldiers in your community. Tell us how you and your fellow soldiers are preparing for what your country is heading into right now, which could very well be a prolonged war with Hamas.
I tried to correct you to the answer. The war is not just with Hamas. The war is with all the civilians that cannot see us as human beings. They want to kill us. Because what I saw in that place near Gaza, civilians from Gaza came on bicycles to the kibbutz just to kill and destroy. It's not just, you know, like people that are warriors of Hamas. I cannot even call them warriors. They are not warriors. Somebody that fights with kids and women is not a warrior. They are not warriors. They are nothing. They are monsters. So monsters from Hamas, civilians from Hamas, and came and killed people from Israel just because they are people. I think it's a war between good and evil. This is what we're preparing. A war between good and evil, war with an enemy that have no mercy, have no ethics, codes, have no codes at all. No mercy kills kids, kills children, kills babies, rape women. No respect for nobody, for old women. No respect for old people. No respect for little kids. This is the enemy that we are preparing for.
Well, that was horrifying, but very honest. I mean, the fact that he says that they're not waging a war with Hamas, but really with civilians, I've actually been thinking that the whole time. You know, it's like all this corporate media coverage that talks about the Israel-Hamas war. It's like, no, it's Israel's bombardment and genocide on Palestinians. And here you have all the religious justifications and all the bigotry and all the racism and all the hatred that they're using to do exactly that.
And this is who CNN chooses to interview, you know, a soldier who specifically says that their war is with civilians.
They could have interviewed anybody, and they decided to interview this bloodthirsty soldier who is really just happy to kill civilians.
They don't even push back on that. We didn't play the whole clip, but there's no like, oh, wait, you mean you're targeting civilians? That's a war crime. No, the anchor never says that, as we would hope that someone actually would if they were a true journalist. But as we can see, the mainstream media is just a cheerleader for war, and they're entirely on the side of genocidal Israel.
So oftentimes on the left, we call this the military media industrial complex. And we can see why, because the war industry is helping fund the same owners and investors in the media who then turn around and feed us warmongering, bloodlust propaganda, and an effort to continue these wars and continue the profits from these wars for the ruling class. So it's no wonder that United States citizens and people living here have been so confused on this issue for so many decades, because we live in the heart of the empire that has been funding this proxy state for decades. So of course, this is the kind of coverage that we're going to get. And so I think a lot of people just look at this as a religious war. They see it as a very complex issue. And the reason they see it as so complex and complicated is because they don't see the basic structural violence and the basic realities of occupation, apartheid, and genocide that have been going on for decades. So we hope we've been able to give you a few lenses and ways of viewing this conflict very differently outside of the corporate media. And we wanted to list a few of our favorite media sources for you. Since we are in the midst of an information war, we find it very important to identify the non-corporate independent media sources out there that can give you some very real coverage on what's happening in Palestine.
Here are just a few of the alternative media sources that are actually reporting the truth on what's happening with this genocide. Democracy Now! Has actually been doing a much better job on Palestine than they did on Ukraine. They've had some really excellent people on there. We've used some clips from them. So their Palestine coverage has been really a breath of fresh air as compared to the mainstream media.
And Democracy Now! Is a daily news show. And so if you really want the updates on how many people are dying, what's going on the ground, it is a great source on Palestine. And they have been on the right side of this issue for decades.
Another good source is Al Jazeera. They've been doing some really amazing work. Their work on debunking the Israeli story on the stray missile that destroyed the hospital. And they essentially proved that it was Israel that destroyed the hospital, something which we knew. But just in general, their reporting has actually been so good that Israel is trying to ban their operations in the country. Al Jazeera actually has people on the ground in Gaza, which is a very rare thing for anyone reporting.
Especially with all the journalists getting killed. Al Jazeera journalists have gotten killed quite a bit reporting in Palestine and in other areas throughout the Middle East. They are really the kind of preeminent source in this area.
We already mentioned Aaron Maté of The Gray Zone. The Gray Zone, him along with Max Blumenthal and other reporters, they also do a really good job of covering what's happening in Gaza. They've had several streams on this and have published several articles. Another good source is Mondo Weiss. They're just a generally a good resource. They've been reporting on Israel and Palestine for years. Just a great resource for the conflict.
We also like the Geopolitical Economy Report with Ben Norton. He's someone that we've quoted a lot on this podcast. He has always had just a really strong analysis on empire and all over the world, especially in Latin America, but also very much in Palestine. Mint Press News is doing a great job. They've, again, non-corporate independent media sources. Chris Hedges, he's reported on a lot of wars throughout the Middle East. He's doing great work. Truth Out, who publishes Chris Hedges, they've been publishing some really good essays on what's going on. Noura Erekat is a Palestinian-American activist, university professor, legal scholar, and human rights attorney, and she has been working on the Palestine issue for decades. If you follow her on Twitter, she is doing an amazing job. She's also been interviewed on Democracy Now! And is just a complete breath of fresh air and non-propaganda voice.
I also want to mention Abby Martin. She's done great work. She's actually produced a documentary on Gaza, and you can follow, you know, what she's doing now. I'm sure she's doing great reporting on the current events too.
Mm-hmm. And there are many others. We're not trying to make an exhaustive list here, but just a few voices, a few independent journalists to get you started if you're new to the non-corporate media.
And Crawdads and Taters too.
Of course.
We also wanted to talk a little bit about a few things we can do. I know a lot of us feel helpless with this conflict. It's a really tough time while this genocide is going on. Our government is carrying out supporting genocide in Israel. So just a few things we can do here at home. A big thing is, you know, supporting the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, something that has been, you know, smeared by corporate media and widely ignored, but just so important that we support that.
Absolutely. And this is a nonviolent way that we can support what's going on in Palestine. And since so many people seem to have trouble with the violent resistance that comes from Palestine, you know, boycotting, divesting, and sanctions is a huge nonviolent way you can get involved. Of course, it's been smeared and called anti-Semitic by U.S. and Israeli ruling class nonstop, but also just speaking out, protesting, helping demystify this issue for so many people that have been confused on it. That's just a huge thing we can do in the United States, because we've been so propagandized on this issue for so long and called anti-Semitic for even mentioning Palestinian human rights, that we have to start speaking up.
Yeah, yes. Share this podcast and all the resources that we've listed here, and tell all your friends, you know, what is actually happening in Palestine, that this is a genocide, that, you know, UN experts have called this a genocide. All the experts on genocide, that's what it is. This isn't a gray issue. This is black and white. This is a genocide that is happening in Palestine.
We want to end this episode with a quote from Noura Erekat, Palestinian human rights attorney, associate professor at Rutgers University, and author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine.
There must be hope, and that hope lies in a political solution and in the responsibility of the international community to dismantle an apartheid system, to dismantle prolonged military occupation, the longest in the world, to lift a debilitating siege that has condemned Palestinians to slow death. This is a human-made disaster, a catastrophe, according to the World Health Organization. This is not a crisis. It is a humanitarian catastrophe. If we are to create a future, it has to begin and end with a political and diplomatic solution.
Crawdads and Taters is a self-produced and directed production by Aaron McCarley and Burian Sundahl. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Pocket Casts, and Radio Public.